Okay, I'm going to whip through this really quickly. I'm talking about Crossref Data Initiatives. I should explain a little bit about myself. I am Crossref's Director of Strategic Initiatives, which basically means that I do new shit. Anything that they've done that is production, I have nothing to do with, and everything that's like new and breaking and stuff like that is my fault. As you may have guessed by the fact that I'm wearing a bicycle clip, I'm also a geek. So this is going to actually be a fairly technical talk. I'm talking about data. Usually use a lot of pictures. It's kind of hard to do with data. So there's going to be text in it. For this, I apologize. I will try and do geek to English translation as best I can. The other thing you might want to know about me is that for a long time I was seconded to ORCID and I was their interim CTO, and that was up until last July. So if you've got questions about ORCID or anything like that, and I notice there isn't a separate ORCID track here, I would be happy to try and answer some of those as well. I will touch on ORCID in the context of the other stuff that we're discussing here. So I want to talk a little bit about the way that at least we see data in Crossref. When we talk about publishing in the publishing world, we focus an awful lot on brands. And a lot of people say to the detriment of scientific communication. And the idea behind brand is that if brand is working, it says something about whether the content contained in a journal brand is relevant, good, and important. And granted, you know, publishers and particular journals could be all over the map on that. There may be even questions about whether those are legitimate things to think about. But they do tend to be the focus of people talking about scholarly communications and journals. But the thing I keep having to point out to people is that underneath that brand sits an entire infrastructure, what I call a provenance infrastructure, that all of these separate, you know, competitive publishers have agreed to over the centuries, and which they really don't even think too much about anymore. You know, and the provenance infrastructure basically tells you all sorts of things about the content that you're looking at. You know, what is it specifically? Where can I get it? What refers to it? And what does it refer to? And by those phrases, I mean broadly, because I'm not just talking about, you know, when I say what does it refer to, I don't just mean citations. I mean it might refer to reagents. It might refer to, you know, to chemical compounds. It might refer to all sorts of things. We only capture a fraction of that at the moment, but we could conceivably do lots more. Then you've got this middle pillar, what's been done to it? Has it been peer-reviewed? Has it been edited? Has it been checked for plagiarism? Who provides stewardship of it? This is an important thing. If something happens to the content, if it's proven to be incorrect, if it needs to be updated, who's responsible for doing that and providing that information? Who funded it? That might tell you something about the angle that the researchers might be taking. And lastly, there in the middle column, what can I do with it? Am I allowed to text mine it? Am I just allowed to read it? Whatever. And then lastly, over here we have who do we credit it to and what are their credentials? Now, Crossref, at one level or another, has been interested in trying to explore all of these sort of areas of metadata, of provenance infrastructure, and in recording that in metadata. And so I'm going to give you a kind of whirlwind tour of this. But first, I want to go back to something that Steve Pettifer did yesterday. He credited me with this. Thank you, Steve, wherever you are. But I like to play a game with people just to sort of emphasize how important this provenance infrastructure is. He did this yesterday, and you look at this, and the interesting thing is you can look at that, not read a thing on it, and you can determine what all the significant bits of that are. A, you recognize it as a scholarly article. B, you can tell what the title is, what the where the authors are listed, where their affiliations are listed. You can see that thing at the top is telling you what it is, what volume it's in, what issues it's in. You can see a footnote at the bottom. If you go to the last page, you have, you know, and then it, you know, obviously if you reveal that, you can say, yes, I was right in all of that. And if you go to the last page, you can see acknowledgments, you can see references, you can see page numbers. Now, one thing he didn't say, and this is why I'm sort of repeating this, is that all of those elements, right, all of those distinctive elements that we pick out that we hardly ever think about are facets of the article that help us do one of two things: either determine its provenance or not read it. Okay? And I like to go on a lot about not reading it, but a lot of those, that apparatus, things like figure captions, things like headings, things like graphs, allow you to skim an article in a highly efficient fashion. I'm not going to talk about that at the moment. What I want to focus on instead is the metadata, the provenance information there that's gathered in this stuff. Now, the provenance information that we started out dealing with, Crossref, is citation data, all right? Publishers, way back when content was first going online, they did two really intelligent things. I know that might surprise some of you here, but they did two really intelligent things. The first thing, which they're very rarely given credit for, is that they did not bother with DRM, at least in scholarly journals. They didn't do anything with it. They just put stuff up online. That was pretty cool. The second thing they did, though, was that they realized that the most useful thing they could do immediately, the most obvious thing they could do immediately, was link references to other content that was online. They also realized something ahead of time, which is that for all the virtues of the web's distributed architecture, for all of its wonders and all of the things that made it scale appropriately, one problem with the web is that links are fragile. They break. And, you know, there's this essay that Tim Berners-Lee gives about, you know, cool URIs don't break, and this is absolutely true. The vast majority of broken URIs are due to the fact that some lazy web administrator someplace has not updated a path when they've moved some content on the same server. And that kind of link should never break, and that kind of problem should go away. But that kind of problem only addresses one side of the URL link, and that is the path. The path is something that the web administrator controls, but sometimes what happens is content actually moves. Companies split, companies merge, companies change their names. There are all sorts of reasons that you might lose control of a domain: litigation, transfer, poverty, forgetfulness, add to that divorce and death. And when that happens, all of a sudden you don't have a way of updating URIs that pointed at your content. You have to do something else. And so what the publishers realized was that, you know, if they didn't do, oh, and sorry, I just have to say, you know, a lot of people will say, well, this is an edge case, you're dismissing it. There are very stable institutions like universities and countries and, you know, government departments and so on and so forth. That's rubbish. You know, they all crumble, they all merge, they all move. In fact, if you look at URL stability studies of it, government departments actually have the worst history of URL stability in any of any sort of you know, of any group. Anyways, this is all important. It's part of the scholarly record. You want these citations to work. You don't want the link to break in 6 years or whatever the half-life is of the URL. So publishers did something that was really rather simple. They added a level of indirection between the citation and the URL. It's very simple. Card catalogs do it with card catalog numbers. DOIs are effectively card catalog numbers. Instead of pointing to the third shelf on the right top, right, they say, actually go to AB16, and then that maps to the third shelf, and you can go and look for the content. You don't, that way they can reshelve things, they can move stuff, and you don't have to rewrite the entire card catalog. All you have to do is update the pointers. Now, it's not magic, right? This is not really fundamentally difficult technology. We could have done this with anything, Perls, XRIs, numlies. We picked DOIs. That's history. Who cares? Because the technical aspects of DOIs are trivial, quite frankly. The really hard part of persistence is the social issues. How do you get people to update the pointers? How do you get them to pay attention to this stuff that's actually inherently boring? And that's an interesting thing about Crossref is that the reason it works, right, is that you sort of, it's like everybody who joins Crossref enters sort of like a suicide pact. It's like if they don't update their DOIs, they don't get reference hits, right? So the minute they're in the system, all of a sudden it's of great interest to them to update these things. So the minute they join, the minute they make this commitment, it actually starts becoming very important to them because all their citations are going through this. So they've got sort of a motivation to do this. The net result, summary, is that we see all of these cool things. We know that if we follow them, we go to a place, we go to a page. But what I want to talk about is I want to talk about what you can do beyond clicking on a DOI with the data that sits behind a DOI. Now, for a long time, you've been able to do a lot of stuff with DOIs, and most people don't know it, because when Crosswave was started, it was more of a B2B organization, right? They didn't really build tools for end users or researchers or third parties doing integration. And we've had a set of legacy APIs, which are really quite powerful if you go and look at them. We have a schema published. You can go. You can use OAIPMH. You can use OpenURL. But more recently, what we've been doing is trying to update those APIs and unify them so that we give you a sort of more modern and consistent experience if you're a developer or a third party. So we've got a whole set of new UIs and APIs that you can use to query the metadata that sits behind a Crossref DOI. And one of them that I encourage you all to go and try is Crossref Metadata Search. It actually allows you to go through all 60 million records searching for, you know, basically it works like Google. You type in phrases, you can find whatever you want. The interesting thing about it is that it's also very good for linking references. So if you've got references and you're trying to find out what the DOI is for them, you can actually just stick them in there and you're going to get pretty reasonable results. The other thing that we've done is we've tied Crossref Metadata Search to ORCID so that people can go in, look at Crossref Metadata Search, search for their name, search for titles that they know they've published, and all they have to do is click on the entry and add it to their ORCID profile. So this is one thing that we're doing where we're trying to link, obviously, the DOI and the ORCID on our side. Clearly, ORCID is doing that on their side as well. We figure the more the merrier, the faster we can do this, the better. So we've built this interface. As I say, there's an API behind it. If you go to the API page, it gives you instructions. It's nice. For those of you who are of a geekly bent, it's RESTful. It uses JSON. These are all keywords for geeks that mean good, if you're wondering what I'm talking about. And as I said, the really kind of cool thing about this is that it actually allows you to do something that a lot of people try and do a really hard way. Often people have a big ream of citations and they want to resolve them to something online. And the first thing they think is, oh, I got to parse this. And parsing citations is hard because citations are just mental as far as the different structures that they come in, right? And what we do is we say we don't need to parse these things. We'll search for them. And we actually get really good results doing that. I think there are a few people here who use the API and can probably vouch for it. The other big thing that we've done as far as APIs is we've implemented content negotiation. Again, this is a horribly geeky term that most of you are not going to know, but basically it means that when you see a DOI like this, normally you click on it and you go to a page. It assumes what's happening is that you're a human, you want to see an HTML representation of that page, but actually what you might be is a computer that wants to look at a computer-readable version of that page. So you can use the exact same DOI and behind the scenes twiddle the header and say, you know what, instead of accepting HTML, I want you to give me BibJSON, and dutifully it will come off and it will give you the whole schmeal of data, anything that we can give you, in BibJSON, and you can go off and do what you want with it. We've worked really hard with data sites, okay, to make sure that they support the exact same thing that we do. So we've coordinated with them. We actually gave them our code. They ran our code for a long time so that it could provide identical content negotiation. I just want to point out, when I see people like Lee Dodds going, wow, look, Figshare has implemented content negotiation. We did it. Old fusty Crossref did it. Anyway, they benefited from it. Bravo. Great. We want that to happen. If you go to to Cross-Site, you can see all the different representations that we support. And I encourage you to try that. The next thing I want to talk to you about very quickly, because I'm running very low on time, is new metadata elements that we have. We have standard bibliographical information in there, minus abstracts. I have to emphasize that. A lot of people go to us thinking we have abstracts. We don't have abstracts. But we have a lot of other information. One thing we have is this generic thing called Crossmark. And Crossmark is designed to do two things. It's designed to record updates or corrections to the literature so that you can trace them from DOI to DOI. And it's also designed to provide a standard way of displaying and providing publisher-specific metadata that they want you, non-bibliographic metadata that they might want you to see. I would go through another game with you where we play this game, which is try and figure out whether a journal article is updated. And I can take you through scads and scads of pages, and we can play this game, and I can show you all the myriad of ways, unique, interesting and absolutely obtuse ways in which journals tell you that there's an update or a correction or a retraction or withdrawal to an article. What we're trying to do is standardize that so that you can actually go to a place and in an easy way determine whether there's any new content relevant that you need to look at. So I'm going to blow through that because I'm running very low on time. The important thing about CrossMark is that it works not just for HTML, but for PDF. So when you stick this thing on a PDF, you open a PDF, you click on a CrossMark, it connects to the server and sees if you got the most current one or if there's a correction or an update. So this is important stuff. And I've just run out of time. I encourage you to go and look at the actual dialog boxes and so on and so forth with CrossMark. I want to emphasize that we're collecting other information now from publishers as well. We're collecting ORCIDs. We have a new initiative where we're collecting funder information and funding and grant numbers, and that publishers are going to start collecting this up front when manuscripts are submitted, and that's going to be included in the metadata. It will also be included in the CrossMarks. We have another new initiative where we're asking publishers to record well-known license URIs in the metadata. So if you support something like Creative Commons or some other well-known license, you can stick the URI in there. That tells somebody something about what they can do with it. We will support embargoes as well if people need those. And finally, we're working with David Schotten to make sure that people who want to participate in open citations can distribute both their bibliographic information and their reference information in the metadata as broadly as possible. The default is that there are some limits for Crossref, and these allow you to override those limits. And the last thing I want you to know is that for those publishers who choose to record links to the full text in their XML deposits, we're also exposing that, so you can actually go use content negotiation to get the full text of an article for text mining or data mining if it's under the correct license and if you have permission. So we got a whole bunch of things here that when you pull them together give you a lot of flexibility in going out, getting metadata, getting content, determining what you can do with it, who was responsible for it, who funded it, and so on and so forth. If you want updates and you want to follow what we're doing, I suggest you go to Crossref Labs where we update things all the time and you can see what we're working on. Anyway, thank you. Sorry for going over.